A swing and a high fly ball. Deep right field. It's a slam.
This is the Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day Show, presented by Amarin.
How about the old Uncle Charlie here? The pitch. Swing and a miss. Threw the fastball right by him, and he strikes him out for the third time. And that's 8 Ks for the Cardinal Herman.
Now, Mike Claiborne and Chris Raby with the Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day Show, presented by Amarin on the Cardinals Radio Network.
Welcome to a special holiday edition of Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day, presented by Amarin. Hope everyone had a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Along with Mike Claiborne, I'm Chris Raby. Ben Boyd is our executive producer. Claibs, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Same to you, sir. It's good to see you. I hope everything went well with you and yours.
You know, it has been a fantastic year of not just Cardinals baseball, but also some of the great conversations we get to have, some of the great shows that you, Mike Shannon, put together from the ballpark. And what a list of guests and what a group of conversations, many of which we're going to get to relive tonight.
Yeah, we were very fortunate this season to have a chance to talk to some people and get some real good stuff. We had some good laughs, and we had some pretty insightful things that took place. And it started off with Keith Hernandez. We laughed a lot with Bob Uecker. Willie McGee is Willie McGee. And I think you and I have the pool going, who's going to get the loudest ovation on opening day? Willie McGee, Jose Oquendo, or the new players that are going to come on board with the Cardinals?
Yeah, there are some good options
Yes. There.
We'll hear from John Smoltz as well, Tony La Russa and Walt Jocketty, Mark McGwire, the Cardinals Hall of Famer, plus Tim McCarver, and we'll talk winter warm-up with Michael Hall just a couple of weeks now from winter warm-up over at Hyatt Regency at the Arch.
It is only just a couple of weeks away, and hopefully we'll have better weather than we had last year where we were iced out, and it was just a real unfortunate situation. But I'm predicting the weatherman will be much kinder to all of us for the winter warm-up.
Yeah, knock on wood, and it's been pretty mild so far, so we hope that 2018 brings the same. What do you think 2018 brings for this club? Because as we've talked about so much, Claibs, very uncharacteristic to be on the outside of the postseason looking in 2 years in a row, but some big additions already for the Cardinals. Their work may not be done, and a real opportunity, and I think the team really relishing the challenge of competing again, not just in the division, but in the National League.
Well, I think they're in a position now where, you're right, they're not trying to win the division. They're trying to get back to the World Series. You know, when you look at this team and you look at what's going on, I would say anticipation, because we're seeing some faces we haven't seen before, and I think there's a newfound resurgence of, hey, we can do this. So I would look at this as being a season of anticipation and hope and staying away from the devastating injury.
Well, we want to see you at the ballpark. Cardinals 5, 6, and 10-game ticket packs on sale now and feature the top promotions of 2018. Choose from the opening day pack, Cubs pack, bobblehead pack, T-shirt pack, and more. Packs start at just $48. Get yours now at cardinals.com/packs. We'll kick off. Great conversation with Keith Hernandez next. It's a holiday edition of Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day presented by Amarin, Chris Raby, and Mike Claiborne with you, Ben Boyd, as well. We're back after this on the St. Louis Cardinals Radio Network. Make your plans to head south this winter for sunny skies, warm beaches, and Cardinals baseball. Packages available to fit everyone's schedule and budget. Make your reservations at 1-800-892-7687 or cardinals.com/vacations. Welcome back. Just getting started. A holiday edition of the program. Chris Raby and Mike Claiborne with you as we kick off some of the great conversations that we've had over the past year. We begin with Cardinals legend Keith Hernandez.
Who taught you how to play the game?
My father.
Okay.
But on a big league level, a lot of people, you know, on a big league level. I learned from a lot of people.
Who did you like to watch
play? Once you got to the
Lou was I mean, Lou gave me great advice. Know your catchers. Mm-hmm. Watch how they're pitching left-hand hitters.
Who did you like to watch play? You mentioned Al Oliver on the opposition. Who were some of the other players you used to look
like? Dave Parker was the best player of his generation for those 3 years when he won the batting title 2 years in a row. Dave Parker could play and throw
and
play the outfield and run. And how intimidating was he? Dave Winfield was a hell of a player with the Padres. Was a hell of a player. And I like to watch him. There's so many players that came down the pike. I mean, McCovey was on his last legs in San Diego then, so too bad. But
McCovey could set pitchers up better than anybody ever saw, because he didn't have anybody
stretch
to protect him down there.
I just saw him, and I just saw him in San Francisco.
I always go over to him.
He's such a wonderful man.
Yeah,
I remember he hit a home run off Dion Drysdale, and Drysdale never threw at him. Never threw
at him. Did anybody throw at you?
Oh, yeah.
Sure,
Shane Raleigh almost took my chin off one time because I peeked once in a while off a left-hander late.
Guys. Okay.
Late in the game, I would never peek. I'd only peek if it was the seventh inning on, tight game, and a left-hander. I didn't give – a right-hander, I didn't care.
Would you peek?
I would want to know area. If I saw the catcher setting up away or in, and I would just pick one or two pitches, and it would be in a clutch situation late and close. And the Phillies got hip to it. So Shane Raleigh undressed my butt one time. I felt the wind under my chin. And so the next pitch, I hit a friggin' bullet right by his ear. Loved it.
What's it like to be in that position where when you're really swinging the bat well and you can do anything you want to do to any pitcher that you're facing, that confidence that you have?
Well, I could play the ball from gap to gap. And that pitch, Mike will tell you, that pitch is down the middle. It's inner half, outer half, in. So it's not off the corners. That's a ball you can pull or a ball you can go
the other way.
So that was the pitch perfect for me to hit and run. It's almost like playing tennis when they kind of disguise their forehand, whether they're going to go down the line. I could do that. But I was taught my whole life to go up the middle. And I was very reluctant to change, and I had a conversation with Don Mattingly 3 years ago, and he's playing at Yankee Stadium where you want to pull.
Yeah.
So I was saying that pitch down the middle, I used to love to get it and just let it come into my – I would see it in slow motion, and I would see the ball leave my bat, and my bat would recoil, and I would just play it into left center field and drive it, not – no ping hitter, you know, no Judy over to left field. I mean, drive it. I could have pulled that pitch and maybe hit more home runs, but I was so afraid to get pull happy that I would get out of my game, and that's my stubbornness and my conservatism, I guess. And that's my rote that I wish I had been a little more experimental and learned to pull.
If you were in San Francisco, you would have, that's the way they taught it out there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So... And Mattingly said, well, I would go, and it was just a matter for me to go to left center field is like golf, hitting it deeper in the, they call it deeper in the strike zone. Okay, get it deeper in.
Mm-hmm.
For Mattingly, it was just go get it a little bit. Go get the bat out of the angle to lift it. And it made perfect sense to me, and I wish someone had told me that when I played.
We're out of time. Mike, I think we got a hitting lesson tonight on how to approach things.
But you have to do it individually, okay? What works for?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you find what works for you.
And it all makes sense, okay? What he's talking about, but it makes sense to him. And for you, it's got has to fall into place, okay? It just has to fall into place, just like it fell into place for.
That's the
for
great
him.
Thing about this game. What works for you may not work for someone else, and
Precisely.
You have thousands of different batting stances.
Hold on a second now, and it didn't work for him at times either.
No.
And he had to learn it, okay? All the things that he's talking about tonight, he had to learn. That didn't come to him, okay? He learned all that stuff, and he paid attention. He listened, and he worked on it.
Yep. And one real quick, I know we got to go. Ralph Kiner was in the booth, and we're Hall of Famer. I asked Ralph one time on a plane, and we were running somewhere, and we're in New York, we're in the middle, flying somewhere, and I go, Ralph, when you went in a slump, what'd you do with your extra BP? And Ralph said, I'd pull the ball as far foul as possible. And I said, what? I would pull the ball down the left field line into the bleachers to get out of my slump. And to me, it was just, I'd go over the shortstop's head, because I'm out in front, I wanted to bring it back. It worked for Ralph.
Did you ever try it?
No, I wouldn't. I didn't hit. I didn't lead the league in home runs 5 years in a row. But hey, that was the darndest thing I ever heard.
That's the one thing about this game,
Mike.
You can come to the ballpark exactly and you can learn something every day from somebody when it comes to that stuff.
And what he did, he applied to himself. Okay. Now, he took a lot of other people to do this and do that, but he applied it to himself, and he learned himself. Okay, he'd say, you know, I can't do that. I have to do it this way. So that's
another
key
thing, too. I was a third hitter. My father always said, third hitter and fourth hitter are the two prestigious spots in the lineup. Your third hitter is your best average hitter. He's a clutch hitter, and he has a good, it was an on-base percentage. He gets on base, sets up, as well as drives in for the guys, the four, five, and six hitters behind
him. Hitters are most talented.
So when I was here in St. Louis, in this big ballpark, I couldn't try to hit home runs, and it was 386 in the gaps. Yeah.
But, you still hit home runs. The number three hitter could do anything.
Okay? Right.
That's, you know, look at your hitters. Musial, Gwynn, they're all number three.
But Stan could have hit cleanup, too, you know.
Well, yeah, they could, but they were all three hitters, okay? DiMaggio weren't right. Three.
So when I went to New York and I had Carter and Strawberry and McReynolds behind me, three guys that hit 20-plus, 30-plus home runs, I didn't have to worry about home runs. I'm now, I can do my thing,
table center,
drive in the runs, and also set up
those guys.
I take great pride in all my cleanup hitters drove in 100 runs.
It's
most
incredible.
Of them, because I scored a lot of runs.
Hey, this is always fun when you come to town. Thank you so much.
It's always good. It's always good to see you guys. And Mike, always good to see you. Mike always treated me good, you know. He got me in trouble one time when I broke out of my slump in Pittsburgh. I hit the triple off of Candelaria. I was in a big, bad slump. And I went out and got drunk the night before. And I told Moon, you remember that? You don't remember?
Go ahead.
So I come into the clubhouse, and Moon goes, I want to do an interview with you. And I go, okay. And he goes, what? I said, well, I just went out and got drunk last night. My dad always told me, when you're really in a bad slump, just go get a heat on. Don't think about it. Go to sleep. Go to the ballpark. I beat Candelaria with a bases-loaded triple. And I told Moon, and he put me on the air. I got more grief in St. Louis after that.
So you're blaming me.
Yes. I had priests calling me and saying, what are you doing?
Hey, donate a car to Goodwill for four free Cardinals tickets. We appreciate Goodwill. We're back. Bob Uecker, a man who needs no introduction, but Mike Claiborne will give one next on Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day, presented by Ameren on the St. Louis Cardinals Radio Network.
Welcome back, everybody. We continue with Countdown to Opening Day here on the Cardinals Radio Network. Mike Claiborne along with Chris Raby. Well, if you're looking for some laughs, we've got the next segment coming your way. The one and only Bob Uecker had a chance to visit with Mike Shannon and I.
One of the great Cardinal moments in broadcasting was when Jonathan Winters walked in the booth with Mike and John.
That was hilarious.
Do you recall having one of those moments? You've been in the booth a long time. You've had a lot of people walk in there.
Oh, yeah. He's one of them.
What did he do with you? Did he go with the Whip Willis routine?
No. I was actually doing the Tim Conway show one night.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we're rehearsing all week. Jonathan Winters is going to play the mother of the Dorf family. Okay? And I'm going to be a reporter, and I'm going to interview him. And I've known Jonathan Winters for a long time, and I'm really looking forward to really working with him to do this Dorf family stuff. First of all, working with Tim Conway is almost impossible because he tries to make you laugh all the time.
Well, the Carol Burnett thing, Corman would
He's unbelievable. Yeah. But with Tim and Jonathan Winters, Jonathan got sick about halfway through the week, and he couldn't do the show, so they got Ruth Bussey to do, Maud Frickert or whatever you want to call her. Well, it was really funny, but it wasn't like Jonathan. You know, I really wanted to work with him. But to try and work with Tim, he's playing a Godfather guy in a tomato patch, and he's that little guy, the Dorf mm-hmm. family.
Yeah.
He's a golf pro. He's a jockey. He had 7 Hall of Fame jockeys on the show. And he was an aerobics instructor. One of the Dorf family was an aerobics instructor. When he came out of his dressing room, and he had a one-piece ladies' bathing suit on. And I'm looking at him, and he said, Bob, it's a living, you know. And then he has these jockeys doing a dance routine. And you know how big they are anyway, right? To be around those guys like that all the time. And I was around them. And I love being around them to do this stuff with them. But Jonathan Winters came into our clubhouse in Los Angeles one night. The Dodgers just beat the tar out of us. They really beat us bad. Bertie Tebbets was our manager at the time. I didn't know Jonathan Winters was from Cincinnati.
Right.
Yeah. Well, he comes walking in the clubhouse, and he's got a Cincinnati Reds uniform on that was so tight, it looked like it was painted on him. You know, his big fat moon sticking out in the back, and we just got beat really bad. And all the guys are down, and then open the door, and here he comes in. How can you not laugh at this guy, right? And he walked into Bertie Tebbets' office because Bertie managed the Reds, and they were great friends. But that's the first time I ever saw him, you know, really where I was close to him. And he's talking really weird, talking about it's not that bad of a game. Well, you can't, looking at him with this tight outfit on, and he's a little beefy at that time. I mean, it was unbelievably funny. And he became one of my favorite guys from then on.
He was hilarious.
You know
the guy in San Francisco that had the, what's the name of that club out there?
The Hungry Eye?
The Hungry Eye, yeah. You know, he gave everybody, well, he and Jonathan were friends. And then when he was sick and he was drinking at the same time, he climbed the mask out there, you know. And Rico went up to see him at the where they sent him at the sanitarium, okay? And there's this guy walking up and down the brick wall with a chair. And Jonathan said, what's he doing? He said, I told him to walk up and down there. When I gave him the word, throw the chair against the wall, we'll all tumble down, we get out. I mean, he had the doctors so messed up, you know, the psychologist and the psychiarist.
They had to go back to night school.
You can't believe it. Hey, when he had that last show he had on television,
we were
in San Francisco and we're having dinner at this place, and he walks in with his entourage and all the
he was unbelievable.
The guys that pay for the show and all that. So he's just down with us at dinner, and they ate and everything. Said Jonathan, his manager kept coming. Jonathan, we're waiting for you.
he was unbelievable.
He had fun. You can't believe him.
Did you ever see the show with him and Robin Williams?
Oh gosh,
no.
It's insanity.
Yeah, more than maybe,
it's
yeah.
insanity. On the Tonight Show, they were on the Tonight Show together. It's insane. But
think of all the people, guys, Bob. If you sat down and wrote,
I've been around. A lot of them. I mean, really.
You know, forget the baseball players, but the guy like we talked about in Pittsburgh, okay? Mm-hmm.
All the actors and actresses and people that have been on the Tonight Shows and the shows that I did with Mr. Belvedere for all those years, 6 years we did that. But all of those people that I met, I never wanted to leave baseball, but all the people that I met outside of baseball, like the Tonight Shows and Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, all those guys, all those shows, all that time, and you're around those people, other guys that hosted the Tonight Show, Burt Reynolds, anybody, Jay Leno. I mean, I met Jay through the Tonight Show and did, after Johnny left, you know, work with Jay. And they're all really good guys. I'm telling you,
kind of guys you'd like to go out and have a drink with.
Oh yeah, no, yeah, hell, yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, they're baseball fans for one thing. Mm-hmm. They laugh at things that you say. I mean, I can talk about anything I want as far as sports activities go.
Well, when you think about it, though, you were such an entertainer to them.
Well, you know, yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the great entertainers of all time, and you were entertaining them.
I remember, like, eighth grade basketball. You know, when you're young, and you know, we're poor. We didn't, I mean, have money. My mother made me a supporter. I remember that. We didn't have money to buy one. And
you didn't share with your siblings?
No, you can't. Okay. Right. And then, you know, you're playing basketball, and she made it out of a flour sack. And there's like little specks of flour dropping out all the time, and the guy guarding you knows exactly where you're going. And then,
it's like,
you know,
rice,
right down the front.
Rice trail.
Right down the front it says Pillsbury's Best. And when you you do that and you're around it enough, it's awful. You know, it's tough.
Final question for both of you guys. I don't know two people who had more fun in this game, in this business that we're in, than you two. You ever think about why God picked you guys to be able to do this?
I think it's because I had such bad coordination, I couldn't hold a regular job. So to be able to, you know, hold a branch, whatever it was, a twig. And speaking of twigs, that's Branch Rickey again.
There you go. Yeah. That's how the show started. Yeah, okay.
That's how we started. Yeah.
You got to get in line for him.
I know. I had an uncle that played minor league baseball with the Tiger organization. So, you know, I was kind of, as a kid, you know, I'd baseball and, mm-hmm. you know, all the stuff that we did Little League-wise. We didn't have Little League then. We had Police Athletic League and American Legion Ball. Then I went from there to Foreign Legion Ball. And I found it, woke up overseas. Well, yeah, I thought I was with the team
best
in America.
Player on Sri Lanka's team, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Sri Lanka, yeah. We had a great club. It was really nice, yeah. Great travel.
Can you imagine, though, having dinner with he and Jonathan Winters?
I wanted to do that show so bad with him.
If you had him, you know, Winters, and Johnny Carson, that, in the
or my buddy
room.
In San Francisco, okay, that ran the Hungry Eye, and he went to visit him when they had him in the padded cell. He didn't know. They didn't know which one to let out. No kidding. He said, no, I'm the one. And Winters are saying, no, he just came to visit me. Yeah. Rock, you know, it's me. I'm coming out.
Boys, I got to tell you, one of the great things about this show is when teammates can get together and relive so many moments like you guys have done tonight is what this show has been all about. And it's been a real treat to have you part of this.
Hey, hold on a second here. Now, wasn't it you that went up against Sandy Koufax and just fouled the ball off, and then you came back by me and said, "Your turn, big boy."
Well, I did.
That's right. I remember that. See,
I remember
you said it's your turn now. He was throwing you curveballs, and you were just trying to let it hit your back.
Who did you hit well?
Koufax.
Koufax. Well, that kept
I came
you
up
the
one night at Dodger Stadium. We were down, I don't know, 3-2. We got the bases loaded. And I'm coming to hit, and as I'm walking up to the plate, I look in the Dodger dugout, and they're all sitting there in their street clothes. This ain't looking too good, you know. But I always apologize to Sandy. I hit a couple of home runs against him because I always thought I was going to keep him out of the Hall of Fame. And who's the guy I hit a grand slammer off of? Ron Herbel. Ron Herbel. He was with the Giants. And I hit a grand slammer off him, and Mike and all the rest of the guys, when I got back to the dugout, they were all laying on the floor. And when Herman Franks came out to take him out of the game, he had his suitcase packed. So Ron Herbel was not long for the big leagues anymore. Yeah, that was a good one, too.
The 2018 Cardinals official calendar spotlights the signature artwork of the team photographers with a special salute to your favorite Cardinals birthdays. On sale now throughout Metro St. Louis, notably the Busch Stadium Team Store, Cardinals Clubhouse Shops, and area grocers, or call 314-345-9000. Plus, the fifth caller right now at 314-531-1120 will win one Cardinals calendar. We're back with Willie McGee next on Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day, presented by Ameren on the St. Louis Cardinals Radio Network. Cardinals 5, 6, and 10-game ticket packs on sale now and feature the top promotions of 2018. Choose from the opening day pack, Cubs pack, bobblehead pack, T-shirt pack, and more. Packs start at just $48. Get yours now at cardinals.com/packs. Well, we are back having fun on a holiday edition of the program. Claves, you mentioned Willie McGee. Always great to see him at the ballpark. We'll be seeing a lot more of him as he joins manager Mike Matheny's coaching staff. Willie with the guys this past summer.
For you, who was a person that you learned from it when you were in the dugout?
Oh, man, with the Cardinals, everybody. I mean, everybody was good. You know, off the field, you know, I had Ozzie, I had George. Stayed next door to George a couple years.
What a great person.
Oh, man.
What an incredible.
I learned so much from this guy as far as the mental, how to handle the ups and downs of the games. You know?
Was he one of the funniest people you were around?
Oh, he's one of the funniest guys. You never. The best story is the one where we won the World Series. And he said he had his car parked under the stadium, and there's a door out in right field. And he said, Willie, by the time you guys got through celebrating, I was at home. I was at home in California.
He drove home that night? Yeah.
That's what he said. He drove home that night.
In his uniform, by the way.
That's what they said. Yeah. And I look, I try to look, and I don't recall seeing him nowhere around.
No, he was not a part of the celebration at all.
That was kind of strange, but I believe that's I'm still looking for him on photos and stuff.
How about the time in Cincinnati when he broke up Mario Soto's no-hitter?
Well, we sitting there in the dugout, and Soto was pitching. You know, he's out there, got the changeup working. He could throw the ball by you, so you can't look for, you know, either pitch. You got to look for set on the fastball and react to the other pitch. So, George, this is his last at-bat, and this is the ninth inning, I believe. Yeah. And Soto made a mistake, threw a ball up close to George's head. George flew back. His helmet flew off, and he's still chewing the gum, never broke his rhythm. Picked his helmet up slow, dusted it off, put it back on his head. The next pitch Soto threw, kind of a medium-high fastball. George hit it off the second deck. So George comes in the dugout, and he said, all the man had to do was throw the ball over the plate because it was two strikes on him, I believe, and out of gate, a man is no hitter. But so, you know, George, you know, things like that are just amazing. That sticks with you, you know, because he, wow.
Yeah, I remember he was telling me, he said, I was going to let him have it till he made me mad.
Yeah, exactly. That's just, you can see it coming.
Oh, what a fun guy. You had so many great teammates, but I want to talk to you about some other people in your life.
Yeah, you see so much stuff around here, man. And, I mean, guys like Whitey, you know, one of the things I seen Whitey do one year is a guy, we were in spring training, and everybody had to be on the field at a certain time. And, I mean, Whitey doesn't play. You know, he ain't going to say much. But mm-hmm. The next thing you know, boom, such and such is gone. And I've seen it on two or three occasions, and it's like, whoa, okay. I don't care who you
three
are.
Three rules, be on time. Play
I don't
hard.
Care who you are. Yeah, he ain't gonna do much talking. Yeah. But the next thing you know, boom, you're gone. And so it's kind of just, you know, that's something that's sometimes it's better, you know, to not say something than to say something. And for instance, here's a funny story about Vince and me. You know, Vince came up, right? And so he's stealing. I give him a pitch. I say, Vince, don't steal third when I got two strikes on me. That's all I ask, and I'll do what you need me to do. So the next thing I know, the next night, Vince out there is two strikes on me. He takes off, so the pitcher throws a curveball, and my eyes attract to the streak that's, you know, because he takes off, so I get distracted. And then I look at try to pick up the ball again, strike three. So I pissed off, man. I'm mad. I didn't say nothing. So the next night, same thing. And I can't believe this because we just talked. And the same thing happened. So I said, okay. All right, I'm a mess with his pockets now. So the next night, the first fastball I see when he gets on, I'm swinging. Wow. The next one, wow. For 2 days, so finally here he comes.
He came, but he had to yeah, break the ice.
I ain't got to go to him and say nothing. He's got to come to me now. I say, man, so he came to me. He said, what's going on? I say, well, man, look, I told you. You know, I asked you, don't steal third with two strikes. And you did it. I looked you right in the eye, and you still did it. So, oh, okay, man, okay.
Okay, cuz.
Yeah, from that point on, we had no problem.
What about Bob Forsh?
Oh, man. It's just another great competitor, man. It's another great competitor, another great team, awesome teammate. Again, I learned so much from Bobby, too, just watching his preparation, watch how he carried himself, watching how he competed. I mean, he's probably, besides Joaquin, probably one of the best competitors that I've been around.
You remember that night he cooled off Jeffrey Leonard?
Oh, do I? Do I? Yes, do I. I mean, you could see it coming.
You know, I don't know if I've ever seen one pitch turn a series around like that.
Good point. Because
Jeffrey Leonard was hitting everything and everybody. And Bob Forsh, here, let me give you something else to think about. And I thought it turned the whole series around.
Yeah, they were awful. They were awful cocky, the Giants, that year. I recall when we were here playing them, you know, when somebody said that, I forgot what they said, but they belittled us. You know, they belittled us with
call it a cow town.
Cow town, and you know, a cow town. Well, this is our town. We're here. I'm here now. I work here. I'm here for 7 months out of the year. You know, that's an insult to us. You know, and so you could just see they're getting a little beside themselves, you know, because we were small, you know, we weren't the big guys.
Big, burly guys.
So they took us lightly, you know, and I never forget sitting by my locker, you know, almost praying, you know. I'm going to say almost praying, but asking.
Well, it's not that. It's okay to pray, and okay. I know you do
all
that.
Right. Yeah, okay.
It's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, not enough, but I do it. But but I'm like, gee, God, if you ever let us win a series, let us win this one. Because I thought that they needed humbling. I really did, and it happened.
You know, the only time I hear guys like that pray in baseball is when they're in a little league. Please, God, don't let them hit it to me.
You've been on a team with a guy like that before?
Hey, might have been the guy a couple of times. You know, back then. Might have been the guy a couple of times back then.
The Cardinals Care Winter Warm-Up will be on Saturday, January 13th through Monday, January 15th. See Willie McGee and more. Purchase winter warm-up admission tickets and autograph tickets at cardinals.com/WWU. John Smoltz, the Hall of Famer, with us next on Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day, presented by Ameren on the St. Louis Cardinals Radio Network.
We continue with Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day here on the Cardinals Radio Network, along with Chris Raby. I'm Mike Claiborne. How about another chat with John Smoltz?
When you first broke in, and obviously you were surrounded by a lot of talent, but who took care of you? You mentioned Leo showed you how to pitch, but what about the veterans? Who was a guy that you kind of looked to?
Well, we had guys like Charlie Liebrandt, Rick Mailer. We weren't very good early, but then they brought in Charlie when we started to develop and win. Charlie was not anywhere close to a pitcher like me. He was a left-hander that had survived a game and knew how to pitch. But I could pick his brain, and he could teach me different things. And then you learn as you go, because you take a 100-loss season 3 years in a row. You go back in the offseason, and you go, what do I need? I'm a guy that always assesses, what do I need to do better? I take pride in that. Even if maybe I didn't accept success as much as early on as I should have, but when I didn't do something right, I wanted to figure out how to do it better. And I sought the information, asked questions, and just put my mind to work. Whereas today, I don't know many young pitchers who ask questions and go backwards and figure out who and how and why you did what you did. Because today, there's so much information, and they have it right at their fingertips that they probably feel like they don't need to ask, you know, the guy before them.
You know, but I agree there's a lot of information. But just because there's information, I'm not sure if everybody can disseminate it and apply it to what their specific concern might be.
I totally agree. I think today I would not have been the pitcher I was in my generation. It would have paralyzed me. All this information would have caused so much in my computer. It's pretty simple. I want to be in the big game, the big moment, and pressure didn't scare me. But the more information that I had to retain, or the more information I thought I needed to know, it would have caused me to not be as naturally gifted and utilize my strengths as well. Some people can do that. Some people very analytical, and it works for them. My processor would have had a lot of trash in the trash can. I think there's value in it. And then, as you said, there's a point of no return where you go so much that you get paralyzed by the information.
Okay, you're with a very good Braves organization. It's you and Avery and Glavin, and along comes Maddox later, and you guys had a really good staff. Then all of a sudden, you have a flat tire. You have the Tommy John. You have to basically get out of line and start your whole career over again. How much of a challenge was that for you? Because Tommy John at that time was something we heard about, we knew about, but as far as the recovery was concerned, there weren't a lot of guys that were coming back from that.
Well, honestly, I was retiring. I was 34 years old. I pushed and pitched through it with a torn ligament for about 3 years, and I figured once it tore, I was done. Mm-hmm. Who's going to wait for a 35-year-old pitcher? Luckily, my doctor, I feel like, had an insight in having Tommy John call me personally. And he called me saying, John, don't give up. I had it when I was 34 years old. Obviously, it's because it's his success. He pitched 11 more years after that, a much different pitcher. But he said, don't. Go through the process. I was so glad to hear from that. That helped change my mind. But I was in a rough point where I was like, you know what, this could be it. I had amassed so many playoff innings. So many innings that really took its toll. It was more playoff innings than anything else. And fortunately,
that's a good thing to have, by the way.
It's a great thing to have. And fortunately, I was able to grind it out. Didn't work out well when I came back as a starter. And with my own idea, I decided to go to the minors to help the team in the bullpen when Bobby didn't want that to happen. And my own idea became my undoing because the success I had that last month turned into this is the only spot we have for you for the next 3 years with the Braves, which was a whole nother chapter that was difficult, but I accepted the challenge.
And you accepted it extremely well, and which leads me to this. There's you, there's Dennis Eckersley. There are a lot of guys coming to the big leagues as starters at one point, but seldom do you see guys make that change to go to the closer. Why do you think that is?
Well, we've made a mistake in Brandon players way too early. Mm-hmm. We've got the Jabba Chamberlain situation with New York. I think I was a false example of what – how many guys have 2,400 innings before they go to the pen? You know, and yet they're thinking 30 innings is good enough. If you don't cut it, 50 innings, 70 innings. I think there's a big mistake in our game. The young kid, Sanchez in Toronto, they're lucky to still have him because they could have played with his mind. He was a closer. He was a starter. Then he went back to the pen. You can't shuffle these young kids into spots. Adam Wainwright is the only exception that I can think of where he did not have a basis of innings before he had the emergency closing role, success, the seventh game, all the pit, you know, the curveball, and then went right into starting. And I was like, oh, my gosh, please, no, no, this is not a good idea. And it worked out. Sometimes the fortitude inside, the ability for a player can leapfrog the unknown of not having 200 innings before. This is what I tell people all the time. I was throwing 200 innings basically every year. I went into the pen and 4 years later decided to come back to starting, and they were all worried there's no way I could pitch 200 innings. And I said, turn over my baseball card. I did this in my sleep. This is something I trained for. It's easy to do if your mindset's right, your train's right, you train right, and your mechanics are right. Today we think it's superhuman to pitch 200 innings. We've dumbed it down to a point where financially it makes sense to the clubs, long-term, no sense. Long-term player availability for the club, no chance. And I think we're in a short-term quick fix that's only going to hurt the game long-term if people don't go back and go, wait a minute, I'm investing $100 million
and this is all
guy,
I get? Yeah.
And he can't go 240 mm-hmm. innings, I'll be darned if that's not going to happen under my watch. But people are okay with it. So, again, I don't think it's the player that is to blame. It's the system of which they're getting rewarded. Same thing with hitters. If you strike out 200 times and you're getting paid, why would you change? So I think there's some flaws innately in the game that have to change, and it's going to take a bold organization to go, we're not going to stay in this river, in this flow. We're going to deviate, and we're going to make ourselves better by doing it.
Make your plans to head south this winter for sunny skies, warm beaches, and Cardinals baseball. Packages available to fit everyone's schedule and budget. Make your reservations at 1-800-892-7687 or cardinals.com/vacations. Hour one in the books. Hour two coming up next. Tony La Russa, Walt Jocketty, Mark McGuire, Tim McCarver. All of that in the next hour right here on the St. Louis Cardinals Radio Network.
A swing and a high fly ball, deep right field, it's a slam!
This is the Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day Show, presented by Amarin.
How about the old Uncle Charlie here? The pitch, swing and a miss, threw the fastball right by him, and he strikes him out for the third time. And that's 8 Ks for the Cardinal Herman.
Now, Mike Claiborne and Chris Raby with the Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day Show, presented by Amarin on the Cardinals Radio Network.
Second hour of our holiday edition of the program. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, happy new year to everyone from us here at the Cardinals Radio Network. With Mike Claiborne, I'm Chris Raby. Claves, a lot of great conversations in the first hour, a lot more coming up in this second hour. What's it like to have Tony La Russa and Walt Jocketty in the same room together talking baseball?
Incredible. When you think about when those two came together here in St. Louis and brought us so much success on the field, those guys were a great combination. And as they look back, they both moved on from St. Louis, but as they look back, they know that their fingerprints are well on the Cardinal organization and its past with regard to success.
Fittingly, kicking off the second hour of our program, the aforementioned Tony La Russa and Walt Jocketty.
You hired Tony La Russa, is that correct?
I did.
Why?
Good question. Well, we've been together for the last 4 days, so we've been going back and forth.
Oh, you think back, though.
No, I'll tell you why. Because, we've spent time together. We've known each other a long time. When he played in Iowa, I was working there as a young lad trying to learn the game. Then in Oakland, we were together. I knew what Tony stood for. I knew what he brought to the game. The dedication, the discipline,
You know, plus he had a pretty good pitching coach he took wherever he went, and that was always a big help. But, I mean, Tony was a leader, and he knew how to get the most out of players. You know, the first few years here we had some issues that we worked through, and finally we put together a team here that we felt was going to be a team that Tony could manage and take on to be very successful, and that's exactly what happened.
So as a general manager, how many managers have you hired over the years?
Only a couple, and he was.
Well, no, not at the big league level. You.
Oh well, with a lot of minor league managers, you know. But
now that's important, though.
Oh, without a doubt, because you know you've got to have somebody that, number one, that will be a leader that will. You know, handle in the major leagues. It's a lot different because you have to be able to handle the media. You have to, you know, he's got to really manage his team and his clubhouse, his players, and deal with them. But he's also got to manage up. He's got to manage up to, you know, the front office and the ownership, and be able to handle that. Be able to deal with the media, and everything else that surrounds the game. It's you know, it looks easy.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I used to sit up there and second guess him all the time. But, you know.
Well, I did too, and I used to go to dinner with him. You know, I'd say, you know, you can't do that. Oh, yeah.
But trust me, it's not.
Well, you
know,
and I used to say on the air right here that, and I'd say, how are you going to argue with a guy that's had this kind of success?
Right,
okay.
Right.
It's his philosophy, and it's worked for him.
So, one thing I always knew with Tony and his staff, I knew that they knew what they had to do to get things, to right the ship, to make sure we got things done the right way. And it, you just, you know, when you hire good people, you stand back and let them do their jobs. And sometimes people try to meddle too much. I think Tony probably thought I tried to meddle once in a while, but, you know, we all did it in fun. But it was, when you have good people, and, you know, we talk things through, and we you know, we didn't always agree on things, but... you know, we always worked it out.
Tony, why did you come here? Why did you take the job when he offered it to you?
Two really good reasons. The first immediate one was, you know, I had spent 10 wonderful years with the A's, and Mr. Haas died, and it was time to go. I thought I was going to stay in the American League at first because you had American League expertise. But Sparky had always told me, Sparky was a real mentor. We talked a lot, and he knew I loved the game, and he said, look, before you retire, you've got to manage the National League because there's a lot of parts of the game, a lot of the nuances, little things that are lost in the American League. American League is a very good league, very tough league, but it's a different league, different brand of baseball here, and you'll enjoy it. The second reason is that it also coincided with Mr. Haas' death. We had a party to celebrate him at the end of the season, and they put Dave Duncan and our wives at the same table with Walt and Sue. And I thought I was sitting next to Walt. Now I know Walt's sitting next to Dunk. And all day long, they're talking. Later on, Dunk says, we got to go to St. Louis because Walt's talking to me about all those great pitchers like Morris and Bendis. And pretty much, once Dunk said we're going.
But, you know, the other thing about bringing Tony and Dunk and Dave McKay and the whole group in was, you know, it was important. And I learned that right away. It was important and imperative to change the culture here, to change how we did things, because, you know, we hadn't won in a long time. And then we're talking about 96, so, you know, the years preceding that weren't very good for quite a while. So it was important to try and change, and I knew that this was the right leadership group to bring in and try to turn things around.
Cardinals 5, 6, and 10-game ticket packs on sale now and feature the top promotions of 2018. Choose from the opening day pack, Cubs pack, bobblehead pack, T-shirt pack, and more. Packs start at just $48. Get yours now at cardinals.com/packs. Mark McGwire, Cardinals Hall of Famer, next, right here on the St. Louis Cardinals Radio Network.
We're rolling here on Countdown Opening Day here on the Cardinals Radio Network. Chris Raby, Mike Claiborne. One of the fun interviews of the year was Mark McGwire. 16 years in the big leagues, 583 home runs, a rookie of the year, two-time world champion, including being a coach. And also, he did a lot of fun things in St. Louis and really, in my opinion, helped revive baseball. He's now Cardinals Hall of Famer. He's Mark McGwire. It is great to see you, sir.
Thank you, Mike.
Congratulations.
Hey, I really appreciate it, man. This is awesome.
I mean, think about this. I mean, the Hall of Fame situation, this has been something that's just come about in the last few years. and you go in pretty early. I mean, what does that say about the impact that you had and how much people thought of you here in St. Louis?
Well, obviously a big impact. I am so thrilled. My family's thrilled. I mean, the 4.5 years that I spent here, to go in the Hall of Fame for only playing really 4.5 years here, it's awesome. I do believe that we, myself and this city, brought the game back in 98. A lot of people had such a bad taste of the game of baseball. It was pretty damn cool. It was very, very stressful. But I really say it's we because of the unbelievable energy and the way they embraced me and the way they pushed me every time I got in the box. It was awesome.
I want to go back to your days in Oakland where you were Rookie of the Year and hit 49 home runs. Life was good. And then all of a sudden things started to happen. Your manager moves on. A few players move on. And then you look around and you don't know any of these guys you're playing with.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, of all people, Mark McGwire's name is in trade talks. Somebody you never thought was going anywhere. Hey, what was that like for you? And then when it was St. Louis, I mean, you've never been to St. Louis before.
Well, that's sort of a funny story because as a 10-5 player, meaning, you know, 10 years in the big leagues and five with consecutive years with one team. So I had the rights to nix the deal if I wanted it. Oakland, we'd been going through some losing seasons. Didn't really know what was in the minor leagues. Didn't know they had a Hudson Boulder and all these other Gazito and all these other guys coming in the wings. Thought it'd be great for me to move on. Thought I was going to get traded to the Angels. I really, really wanted to go down and play in Orange County.
That's your backyard.
That's where I live, yeah. I really did. It didn't work out. Sort of about a week prior to the trade deadline, we're on a long road trip in the East Coast. I was getting worn out. I was in a horrible slump. Come back from the road trip, and the next thing I'm driving across the Bay Bridge on the 31st and get a phone call from my attorney, Bob Cohen, and said that there's a trade in line, and do you accept it? And I said, yes, I do. And it happened to be with the St. Louis Cardinals. And really the reason is because of two people, Tony La Russa and Walt Jocketty.
Yeah.
That's really the only reason that I accepted it, because obviously Tony's like my second father. Walt was the assistant GM that signed me in 84 out of USC next to Sandy Alderson in Oakland. Coaching staff, Dave Duncan, Dave McKay were here. Trainer Barry Weinberg was here. And I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. But
you knew you were going to put the band back together for the most part.
Well, I knew I needed to a new place to go. Mm-hmm. Just something different. Go ahead.
Okay, right. So you get traded. You say, okay, now we're at St. Louis. What time zone is that in? What was it like when you first stepped on the field and the reception you got? Because obviously, as you know now, Cardinal fans know a lot about baseball, and they know about a lot about good players on other teams. What was that like for you?
It's probably, to this day, one of the most meaningful times of my life as a baseball player. Well, to go back to the story, so I was in a horrible slump. Then I fly from San Francisco to Philadelphia. I land at 5:30. I'm thinking, I'm not going to play. Tony's not going to play me. The game's at 7:05. I get there around 6:30. I'm in the lineup. I'm sitting there going, does he know that I'm really, really bad right now? And I proceeded to go, I don't know, 2 for 28 on that road trip until they got back to St. Louis. So that night of August 8th, my first time here in Busch Stadium, standing ovation.
For a 2 for 28 guy.
Well, and then you add on the probably 2 for 30 right before that. And I'm sitting there thinking, this doesn't happen. I mean, to think about, like, when you're in a slump and you think that you're the only one in one, there's no way out. You're really, really bad. And then all of a sudden you get traded, and the slump continues. And then you go to a new ballpark,
new
with
league,
all these fans, new league. And you're like, what are people going to say? And they're saying, what are they trading for McGuire? What do they give up these prospects for McGuire for? Well, they showed me. It was unbelievable.
For you to be absorbed that moment, obviously had a lot to do with you not testing free agency, because you were a guy that could have wrote your ticket anywhere, but you were comfortable, obviously, with the environment, ownership. You mentioned Tony and Walt and the people around you. How much of a thought process did you have as far as free agency, or was this it for you and just say, let's just do this?
To tell you the truth, I really thought I was going to be a rental. I came here with an open mind, but sort of leaning towards being a rental. Let's feel it out. But that first at bat won me over. So I wish and I hope that, and I tell players today, that if you ever get an opportunity to put a Cardinal uniform on, go for it. It is going to be the most meaningful time of your playing career.
Let's talk about 98. You finished like you knew what you wanted to do in 97, at the end of 97. And here comes 98, and then everybody says, you know, this guy might be able to break Maris's record.
Yeah.
I don't know if you put a lot of thought into it, but I thought you handled it in a manner where you said, let's not even get into it until I get to 50.
Right.
But what was it like for you? And also your teammates, because you were, no matter where you went, whether it was the men's room at a bus station or Shea Stadium, somebody was going to talk to you about it. Yeah. and also ask you about it.
Yeah. Well, so a lot of these things I probably really haven't talked about, but they're all in my mind. So maybe someday if I ever write a book, but here we'll talk about it here.
Sign that copy for me. I want the first copy, please.
So they've talked about me breaking this record since 87, when I had 33 home runs at the break. So I've always been tabbed to do it. Why, I have no idea. They've picked me. Then I had my struggles. Then I come into 98, and everybody thought 98 was going to be the year because of the year of expansion. And they said, okay, the expansion, the game, you know, is going to have a lot more pitchers that, you know,
have no
business being in the game, blah, 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 okay? Remember being on the cover of Sports Illustrated for the baseball issue. Going to spring training, and that's all everybody talked about. Okay, so I took it in stride, and I'm like, okay, that's fine. I have no problem talking about it, but really, let's not talk about it until you get to 50. I mean, if you look at the math, you have to average 10 or more home runs each month to even think about doing it. Well, March 31st, first home run, first game, grand slam. September 27th, number 70. Unbelievable. I mean, to this day, I truly believe that there hasn't been an athlete that has been singled out to break a individual record in any sport. Yeah. To this day, and to deal with what I had to deal with. I have not seen it in my lifetime, and I don't know if we'll ever will see it again, but it was definitely unbelievable. It was definitely stressful.
Did you have a chance to enjoy it and really inhale what was going on? Because we used to watch you every day, and you know
when
a lot of people wanted to see you do it, but, man, we just knew it was like the Bataan Death March on certain days.
Well, you know, It was all this, you know, when we started doing these press conferences, you know, before we went to the city and then, you know, I tried to deflect as much as I could from my teammates, and, you know, it didn't matter if we won or lost. If I didn't hit a home run, they always wanted to come talk to me. And I thought that wasn't fair to my teammates, because there was a lot of my teammates were having really good years at the time, and they weren't getting the accolades that they should be. And sometimes I felt embarrassed about that. But I understood it. You know, I think some of the media thought I was honoring. But then again, when you had to talk about the same things day in and day out for seven straight months in spring training, I mean, there's days you're not going to feel good about talking about it. But I'll tell you what, though. When I got between the lines, that was my sanctuary. Mm-hmm. So that was my peace, as you want to say. Nobody could get to me. I knew what I wanted to do that day. I always took naps before the game. I visualized the pitcher. I visualized how the ball was going to move. I did everything I could do to prepare myself for that game. And then when I got out there, it was just pure. I was in my own world, and I was inside my own mind, but three or four times inside it. I mean, it's. I don't know if any. There might be a few people that understand what I'm talking about right now, but there's places in your mind that you can get to if you're that tough mentally. But I can only imagine what Roger went through being in New York and along with the Babe, and it's just like, you know, I got an opportunity to do it here in St. Louis, and I just can't thank the fans enough for. I mean, it's just like the feeling that you get when you put this uniform on is incredible. And it is. It's a one-of-a-kind uniform. And I know, you know, every player cherishes it when they put it on here in St. Louis.
Make your plans to head south this winter for sunny skies, warm beaches, and Cardinals baseball. Packages available to fit everyone's schedule and budget. Make your reservations at 1-800-892-7687 or cardinals.com/vacations. Tim McCarver next on Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day, presented by Ameren on the St. Louis Cardinals Radio Network. Welcome back. It's a holiday edition of the program. Chris Rabe, Mike Claiborne with you. And Claibs, a chance now to visit with Tim McCarver. Always great to have him. Always great to hear him now on the television broadcast with our buddy Dan McLaughlin. It's been great to have Tim around the ballpark so much and around the club so much over the last few years.
What a breath of fresh air he is, Chris, at this stage of his career. Really knows the game and likes teaching and talking the game. But one thing about Tim, he's more than just a baseball guy. You can roll out a subject, and he's going to know a little bit about it where you can carry him around to any party you go to. Just a fascinating person that we had a chance to sit down and visit with.
You played on some of the great teams in the history of this organization, that be it the St. Louis Cardinals. And it just seemed like from the stories I've heard and the pictures I've seen, you guys had more fun than maybe the law should allow. You didn't have ESPN. You didn't have a lot of things to do. And you guys basically traveled in packs. How much fun was that for you, especially as you look back on your career? We talk about the black player, but, man, you know, does it make a difference when you're winning what color anybody is at that point?
No.
Because you were having so much fun.
No.
I think one of the neat things about Haberstram's book was, you know, you guys were a team that had a lot of really good black players on it. So how much fun was that for you? And do you think people in today's game have as much fun? They have more money. But I don't know if they have as much fun.
The game has changed, unfortunately, from that standpoint. I say unfortunately because, you know, I guess they have fun. It's just a different type of fun.
Mm-hmm.
The players are bigger, stronger. But nobody, and I'm trying to be as objective as I can when I say this, nobody were into each other. Like we were.
Mm-hmm.
We were into, we really admired each other as teammates. I mean, to a man, we admired the wisdom of George Crow and Bill White. We admired the baseball knowledge of Dick Groat, who taught me more about base running than anybody I've ever talked to. Kenny Boyer, referred to as the captain, even when he retired, he was still the captain. He was like Pee Wee Reese. Mm. And Jackie Robinson's day with the Brooklyn Dodgers, always referred to as the captain. And, of course, Bob Gibson. He was a marvel then, is a marvel today, the way he's led his life, the way he looks like he's 60 years old. Mm-hmm. He's 81 years old. It's hard to believe.
It is.
In 3 months, he'll be 82 years old. I know he'll listen to this broadcast, and I'll get a phone call.
Sure,
I'll guarantee you don't have to stress things like that. We were into each other. We admired each other's play. We had 25 managers on that club. We had actually 26, and Red was our lead manager. He would come to the mound, and you've heard these stories, but in double play situations, infield in, because of the way we were trained by George Kissel, Eddie Stanky. We knew how to play the game. We knew how to run the bases. We knew what to do in situations where if runners are on at first and third and it's a tie ball game in the seventh inning and there's speed at the plate, you may not have a chance for a double play. So play the infield about halfway, not all the way in, but not double play depth either. Mm-hmm. We knew stuff like that. And when we had meetings on the mound, Red would come out and he'd say, what do you guys want to do? And we'd tell him. And we did it. And, of course, often it didn't work out. But more often than not, it did work out. And I've said, I think everybody, Mike, who played during that period, thought that that period was the best time to play ball. That the pitching, pitching was superb in the 60s, that decade of excellence with Perry and Gaylord Perry, Juan Marichal, Billy Pierce, and guys, and of course Bob Gibson and Steve Carlton getting his start in 66, Drysdale and Koufax. I mean, Koufax, but he and Gibson, you got to put them in the top five ever. I think.
No doubt. No,
As far as intimidation, Koufax with his stuff, Bob with everything that he presented against the team. But we were fans of each other.
Who was the guy? Because that team had skill. It had a lot of talent.
Had speed.
Had a lot of speed. Good base runners.
Had very knowledgeable base runners. Yeah. We always knew when to take the extra base, for the most part. I mean, we made mistakes, but they were minimal.
Who kept things in perspective, if not keeping it loose? Because
Cepeda kept it loose. Believe me. Cepeda kept it loose. And, you know, he was traded in 1966, and he was offended. And those days, you were more offended because it surprised you. Mm-hmm. It surprised everybody. It was Orlando Cepeda for Ray Sadecki. And we all picked up on that, and we were very sensitive to understand. I mean, he's come to a totally different environment, the Midwest in St. Louis, from San Francisco, no less. A team that had its origins in New York City. I mean, a guy who was so good, he was a rookie of the year. He was our MVP in 1967. And we had many talks together. And I told him, Orlando, you know, the Giants are going to forget you very quickly. That's the callous part of this game. We've all got to be, you know, it hasn't happened to me yet, but it will.
Happens to everybody.
And even Gibson would say, you know, it'll happen to me. I said, you might be
the one guy.
you and Musial and guy, there are a couple guys that we're not going to put on that list. Sure enough, I think that helped him. And the fact that we received him with such warmth, I think, made a big difference in what kind of player he was. It's hard to prove, but he was a runaway MVP, the first ever runaway MVP in 67.
I remember the story or the visit you had with him on a broadcast a couple of years ago. And
oh, yes.
You made light of the fact that you took him to his first concert. What, Sergio Mendez of Brazil 66?
Yeah, good for you. Good for you. You remembered that. Yeah, I mean, he had never heard everything in Orlando's life is wrapped around music. If you call him on the phone in California, and I get out to California occasionally and spend some time with him, have dinner together once or twice a year. But everything is centered around music. I mean, you've got to go through a minute of his music to get to the answering machine to tell him who called. Believe me, you do. And I said, wait a minute. You've never heard of Sergio Mendez in Brazil 66? And matter of fact, Sergio Mendez is still around.
Right.
They're like Brazil 2017 or 20 or whatever. This guy's ageless.
He's like a Timex, man. He just keeps on ticking.
Yeah, but Orlando hadn't. And also, another guy, and the name escapes me now, he sang the national anthem before the game.
Jose Feliciano.
Jose Feliciano, right. He had never heard of Jose Feliciano, and to this day, he and Jose Feliciano are very close friends.
That's amazing. It's amazing how this game brings people together.
It is. More than any other game.
Yeah, I agree. There's no doubt.
I think.
One of the great things that I've always admired about Tim McCarver, you have that recall where you can roll names out that if somebody's listening to this.
Even
now,
though I just forgot
Jose Feliciano. But you know what? We'll give you a mulligan on that one. But just like the McCarthy guy who you've known since
John
the bat
and Arthur
boy.
McCarthy.
Exactly. I've always admired that because there are a handful of people. I try and do it about certain things that interest me, but I roll those names off and people look at you like, why would you remember that guy's name?
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how you do it, which is why I say you're the eclectic man, because you have other things that you enjoy. You've written books. And I wonder, why don't you write more? Because you have so much to offer, not just to the game.
I've never been asked that, but I've written 5 books. And I've enjoyed, but I had some help in doing mm-hmm. that, you know, with the punctuation and stuff like that. The
you don't have the run-on sentence for like 280 pages?
No, I can't even type. Are you kidding me? I enjoyed life. And part of that, and this is going to sound like a schmaltzy party line, but part of that, I think, was the passion of the Cardinals and what they had in the 60s. We not only won pennants in 67 and 68, we ran away with pennants. And very few teams were running away from things.
Follow the Cardinals in style this coming season with a subscription to Cardinals Magazine. Sign up today and receive 2 free tickets, all for just $35. Order now at 314-345-9000 or cardinals.com/magazine. We'll talk winter warm-up with Michael Hall from Cardinals Care next, right here on Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day, presented by Ameren on the St. Louis Cardinals Radio Network. Winter warm-up coming up. We're inside a month, January 13th, 14th, and 15th at the Hyatt Regency St. Louis at the Arch. And joining us is Michael Hall, the Vice President of Community Relations and the Executive Director of Cardinals Care. Michael, happy holidays. How are you, man?
I'm doing well, Chris. Thank you.
You know, we are so excited. Again, winter warm-up. It sneaks up on us every year. Maybe not you guys, because I know you're working on it all year, but what's this last month like as tickets go on sale, admission tickets, autograph tickets, and we get closer and closer to the event that benefits Cardinals Care?
It's fun. It's a lot of fun and trying to plan everything, and it can get a little hectic, but that's the nature of the business. We enjoy it, and just being able to communicate with everybody within the organization and trying to put on a great event for the fans, it's always fun to do.
So tickets on sale now, the admission tickets online or the Busch Stadium box office. You can go to cardinals.com/WWU. If there are folks out there that are not familiar with the event and all the money it raises for Cardinals Care, give us a little bit of background, Michael, and how folks can get involved and enjoy a great weekend and help raise some great money.
Sure. Yeah, the winter warm-up is our fan fest. It's a version of a fan fest. A lot of teams have fan fests, but ours is a little different than others. We use it as our major fundraiser, our largest fundraiser for the foundation, Cardinals Care. And the entire weekend, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, is dedicated to that. And we ask all of our players to come in for the event. We include some of our Hall of Famers. We include a lot of our alums. We include some of our minor league players and try to bring a nice variety for fans to see. And some of the players will get a chance to hear from the main stage, as we may get a chance to do some question and answer with them. They all will sign autographs, and some fans have purchased autograph tickets for that opportunity. So it's a big event. It's a family event. There's a dedicated kids room where there's a lot of activity down there for kids, and a lot of our promotional items that we give away are Cardinal themed items for kids. If they go down in the room and participate and hear some of the presentations that we have specifically for them down there as well. We have a vendor area where there's a lot of sports memorabilia, not just baseball, but a lot of sports memorabilia that fans seem to enjoy and like to walk around and interact with all of those the folks down there. And our breakout rooms are also pretty popular, where we try to include things in and around the ballpark that fans may not have exposure to. For instance, having the opportunity to ask questions to Team Fred Bird, or have an opportunity to spend some time with maybe the team photographers and ask kind of, you know, different questions that fans may be interested in that regard. Dan Farrell always does a nice presentation for us and talks about some of our marketing efforts and our ticket sales and different opportunities as it pertains to tickets and marketing throughout the ballpark. So we try to incorporate a lot of different things for fans as part of our version of a fan fest that culminates as a fundraiser for our foundation.
And how about all the work that you guys are able to do? It's been now 20 years, believe it or not, more than $12 million in grants to nonprofit youth organizations. You guys continue to build ball fields, 23 of them. It just keeps getting bigger and better for Cardinals Care, doesn't it, Michael?
Well, we try, and it's the fans that help us. The fans, and of course, as I just mentioned, all of our players, current and former, that, you know, the fans want to see, they want to try to interact with, and we've been very fortunate that our players understand that, recognize that, and they help us to raise the money for the foundation, and that's how we've chosen to put it back into the community, the majority of it, through our flagship program, Redbird Rookies. It's our youth baseball program, through the ball fields, as you mentioned, that we try to build to support the Redbird Rookies program and the grants that we give out each year. So it's a combination. We're very fortunate to have the great fan base that we do and the buy-in from our players.
Michael Hall is with us again. Winter warm-up, it's coming up next month. It is on January 13th, 14th, and 15th, Hyatt Regency, St. Louis at the Arch. How do you guys keep coming up with new ideas to keep this thing new and to keep it fresh, Michael? Because I know there are fans that maybe they're coming for the first year this year. Maybe they're coming, for the 10th year. But it seems like you guys are able to adjust and keep things new and keep fans on their toes every year.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, the fans, we get a lot of feedback each year from fans, and we respect that and we listen to it, and the things that we are able to incorporate, we try to incorporate them. Different ideas, different suggestions, maybe it's different presentations from the main stage that people are able to enjoy, or maybe it's different presentations, as I mentioned, in some of the breakout rooms, or just different things that fans may want to have access to as part of the event. So we try to take that feedback and incorporate it if at all possible. We try to learn from what worked well the year before and what maybe did not, so that we're trying to make adjustments each year. So we take the feedback very seriously, and we try to make it better each and every year, because we do. We want people to continue to come who have come in the past. We always enjoy seeing them. There's a lot of familiar faces when we're there. Like you said, it's been over 20 years, so a lot of recognizable faces from fans that come each year. And then we also really encourage people who have not been able to participate or have not experienced the winter warm-up to give it a try. It's all 3 weekend or all 3 days over the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, and it's a great opportunity to come down and just be a part of Cardinal Nation.
Again, go to cardinals.com/WWU. You can buy tickets. You can see the autographed tickets, both the paid and the free tickets, and get all the information that you need. And we hope to see everyone at the Hyatt Regency St. Louis at the Arch January 13th, 14th, and 15th. Michael Hall, the Vice President of Community Relations and the Executive Director of Cardinals Care. We appreciate it, man. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds great. Thank you, Chris.
Back to wrap things up in a moment on Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day, presented by Ameren on the St. Louis Cardinals Radio Network. Stuff those stockings with the 2018 Cardinals official calendar, spotlighting the signature work of the team photographers with a special salute to your favorite Cardinals birthdays. Pick up this must-have holiday gift at St. Louis area retailers or call 314-345-9000. Plus, we'll make someone very happy right now. The fifth caller at 314-531-1120 will win one Cardinals calendar. Well, that's going to do it for us tonight. We will see what 2018 brings for the Cardinals after an already exciting offseason and quite the start to our Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day shows. Thank you to all of our guests. Thank you to Mike Claiborne as well, who did all of these interviews that we were able to bring you tonight. And our great executive producer is Ben Boyd. Thank you to Mike Anderson and Zach Schmidt helping us behind the scenes as well. Happy New Year. This is Chris Raby. We'll talk to you next week in 2018 for Cardinals Countdown to Opening Day, presented by Ameren, right here on the Cardinals Radio Network.